Accession number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Reel 15. Now, what? How did you feel when you came to leave these men? You'd been with them a long time. They're a family unit. You've got a friendly discipline. You knew everybody. They called you Chalky. You know, how did you feel when you actually came to leave them in the line in July 1952?
Well, I remember we were still at that position. We were still semi-dug in sort of thing. We were still digging holes, you know, the command posts and the gun pits and things like that. So I went round to all of them and each of the four guns and all the lads in the different gun crew sort of thing and shook hands and things like that. And the same within the command posts, and they all bid kind of envious farewells. And I felt a little bit sad going, really. Although, you know, kind of I was quite happy to be leaving there in kind of one piece and things like that. But also kind of the final thing, you went to the troop commander sort of thing. And of course, I suppose it was part of his orders as well to try and get the national servicemen to sign on. And of course, he jokingly asked me, you know, kind of sign on sort of thing and all the good things would happen and things like that. But anyway, he big smile, he shook hands and bid, you know, farewell and things like that. So after that, it was kind of a little bit of an anticlimax, really. Just boarded one of these 1500 weights with my kit bag, because I'd given most of my kit away sort of thing and things like that, you know, kind of people who wanted bits and pieces. So we went back to battery headquarters, and then from then onwards, I can't remember, I don't think it was there very long, and then eventually we went to where the train used to pull in and that, and we boarded the train. And by this time, I all remember that the actual train was an American diesel locomotive. It was so different from the old steam driven thing we first went up to the line in Korea. So we went down actually on this train, and this is where I met my old friend from Nottingham, who I'd met on the very first day at Oswestry when we signed the documentation.
The one who was wounded, Pick. Is another one.
Yeah. And of course, actually, when we were going back, so we went back to some camp in Pusan. We took us right down to Pusan and that. And so we went, and of course, because I'd got no equipment at all, and of course, the person in charge of all the equipment handing it out, he was most upset because I got so little sort of thing. And of course, being in the kind of frontline concession, you didn't have to pay for it, things like that. So he wanted to know what had happened, and I said well, the dugout went up in flames and we lost all the equipment and we were never really properly equipped after that. So I was more or less practically given all new equipment, like socks and pants and vests and all things like that. And then of course they took this wintry type clothing off us and things like that, and they issued us back with a battle dress. And that's the time when they gave us this pin bar of the British Medal of Korea and the United Nations Medal and things like that. It was just like a pin thing where you put
it
on.
Did they give you a medical as well?
Yes, we had to go to a medical, because we had one or two medicals kind of that period, and used to go in there and they used to delouse you. They used to put all this puffing stuff and all things like that. Because
was it a serious medical? Was there anything wrong with you?
I had no problems at all, apart from kind of when I had problems with my feet and kind of that. And I say they gave you quite a reasonable medical, you know, testing for your heart, and I suppose they tested to see if you got VD and all those types of things and that. But there was no problems, and so within matter of, I suppose, I can't remember whether it was an odd day or something, we then boarded the troop ship and Pusan, and we was off to back to the UK, and it was
which was this.
The troop ship was the Empire Orwell. Now, the Empire Orwell was one of the better ships, really. It was one of the German ex-German liners, and it used to have two funnels, and of course it also had the all the cafeteria systems and all the bits and pieces, and it was quite a good journey going home.
It was comfortable.
Oh yes, it was the same thing where we had the three standees for the troops. There was no cabins or nothing like that, but the food was quite good, and they didn't bother you too much. And of course, going home, we called in most of the ports we came out in, like Hong Kong, Singapore's and Colombo's and all places like that. And so each of these places we called in, it was shore leave and that. But I can't really, because I was more or less joined it with my friend from Nottingham who I met on the first day, but I can't ever remember we actually talked about our experiences in Korea, because he was actually on the Bofors where I went on the mortars.
So anything much happening? It's just a trip home, really.
Well, our first port of call, we called in at Hong Kong, and of course we knew Hong Kong quite well. And of course we dropped off at the Star Ferry in Kowloon, and of course I remember we went in, I suppose we had something to eat and something to drink and things like that, but I was a bit disappointed, really. I never had time to go into this photographic shop, because before I left Sword Thing, I had this colour photograph taken, and they had this huge, great big thing, and it was projected in a frame on an easel, actually in the window of in the shop window. And of course, before we went to Career Sword Thing, I think I went in and made inquiries, and I think it was about 19 Hong Kong dollars. And of course, at that time, I hadn't got 19 Hong Kong dollars, and so I hadn't really got time to really go to fetch this. But you see, I couldn't have taken it to Career anyway, because it had been destroyed by the weather and the cold and the rain and what have you.
So you travel. Nothing much happened in the visits ashore.
No, we after Hong Kong, we then went. We picked up troops from Hong Kong, taking them home, and that, and then we called in at Singapore. And this time we was allowed to land, sort of thing. And we went into the centre part around where the St Andrew's Cathedral, and there's a big square where they used to play cricket, and I think there's the big hotels and things like that, and we had a few drinks. I can't remember too much about it, but I do remember Singapore with all the, it was nice to see all the tree line parts when we actually, you know, the palm trees and that, and there was all these you know, luxurious kind of speedboats and things like that. And then we then moved across the Indian Ocean to Colombo in Ceylon, but this time we was able to purchase all these little ebony kind of things to bring home, and ebony elephants, and I've still got some on the television there, and all things like that. You could pick up all this fruit and things like that. And then we missed Aden. I'm not sure whether we missed Aden or whether we went in there to pick up water. But the big disappointment to us then, we actually moved into the Red Sea and up through the Gulf of Suez and up through the Suez Canal. And it used to take about a couple of days to get up there, because the ongoing and the shippings, you know, kind of one line used to stop while the other came down, and then it moved up. And when we got to port side, they wouldn't allow us to actually disembark, because the Suez crisis was beginning to ferment, sort of thing, and things like that. And of course, lots of the lads, they were quite disappointed, and they thought, well, we've been to Korea, we'd have no problems landing in port side. But that was it. And then we then moved into the Mediterranean, and we followed along the coast of Libya, and we called in at Tripoli, because Tripoli at that time was still, the British troops were still in Tripoli after, you know, since the after World War II and things like that. And so we called in at Tripoli, and we picked up some troops there, and then we went past Malta, and then we went through Gibraltar, but we didn't stop in Gibraltar at all. And then we went up into the Bay of Biscay, and this was the summer period as such, and of course the Bay of Biscay was lovely and smooth, just the opposite to when we came out in January. And then we eventually started moving into Southampton, but they wouldn't let us go in at first, so we had to stay outside. And I always remember the liner Queen Elizabeth coming out, because when we left Southampton a couple of years previous sort of thing, it was the Queen Mary, but coming out this time, the Queen Elizabeth QE1, as it was then, came out, and they gave a big blast on their foghorns and things like that. And then the American ship, it's called the United States, this is one had just won this this trophy, you know, kind of crossing the Atlantic, that also came out, and they gave us a blast of welcome with the you could hear the tannoys going about, mentioned about this ship coming back from Korea as they passed us and that. And then eventually they allowed us to come in into Southampton.
This would be August by now, would it?
About the August period it would be, yeah. And so we was actually coming into Southampton, and of course as we actually docked, they wouldn't allow us to get off for a long, long time. And I do remember, I think what they were doing, this welcome party, because on board the Empire Orwell, we came back with the complete battalion of the Royal Leicesters. It was the Royal Leicesters who went to Korea the same time as us. They'd done their stint, or was it 3-year Python, I suppose, from Hong Kong and Korea. And so the regiment as a whole was coming back. And so the Royal Leicesters, for the pomp and pageantry, had to get off first, and they had all on the we was able to watch everything there. They had the movie tone cameras, and I'm not sure whether they were television, but they had the mayor of Leicester there and all these dignitaries. They had a brass band welcome us and things like that. And then eventually the different units went off, I suppose, like the signals and the engineers and things like that. And then the gunners went off, and we went into this big warehouse type thing, and all these customs people all came out, sort of thing. And we all had to empty our kit bags all on the, well, I suppose, the quay side and things like that, because I think they were quite concerned about people bringing back guns and ammunition and all things like that, and bayonets and that. And
was there a proper search then?
Or they came along, and of course people have got all these lots of cigarettes, because I myself, because I did not smoke as such, and where we used to have a issue of 50 cigarettes at least every week, and of course I'd stockpile with lots of these American cigarettes, and I'd loads of these cigarettes in the bottom of my suitcase, and I brought them home for my father's things. But they didn't seem to bother about what they were after, was kind of guns and ammunition and all things like that, because people had acquired especially these American 4.5 pistols and all things like that. And I understand other people had even got, you know, kind of even larger things in other different units. But anyway, they went through it, and this is what they're after. Then afterwards, we then boarded this train, and they then took us back to Woolwich Barracks, which is kind of like the in London, which is the gunners transit camp and that. And when we actually got in there, and they started trying to mess us about in general and things like that. They wanted to start blanking our big kit bags and gaiters and all things like that. And of course the lads weren't too happy, and also they started putting us on guard and things like that. And but then the other ironical thing was that we had this two medal pin, which, you know, on a uniform, things like that. And of course, like with all the normal regular soldiers, they have to sew their ribbons actually onto the uniform, and they tried to get us to sew these ribbons actually on the uniform, and people just refused, and they said they wouldn't wear their medal ribbons. And of course, I suppose this upset the authorities, and so they rescinded that offer, things like that. So we was then in Woolwich Barracks for so many days, I can't remember quite which. We then had another medical, and I remember kind of going into this medical officer. I think it was only, I think it was a young medical officer, what I remember of it. And of course, you had to strip off kind of completely naked as such and things like that. I suppose they wanted to test your heart and see if you got all these creepy crawlies still, because we all had lice in Korea and things like that. And I think they sprayed us again under their armpits. And then, of course, you had to stand there, sort of thing. And I do remember, because I suppose they wanted to inspect if people had got venereal disease, you know, kind of people had been to Hong Kong's and Japan's and all places like that. And I do remember we was on this with a couple of these old-time regular soldiers. I think there are the 5 years or 7 years had come to an end. And standing there, and of course he wanted to inspect you. And of course I always remember that one of these fellas, he got this huge erection, and the medical officer came out, and he was most upset, sort of thing. And he says, "I'm going out, and I want to see different when I come back," sort of thing. Because if not, he says, "I shall keep you here," sort of thing, "and you'll miss your demob period," and things like that. And of course, when he came back again, because there was this big roar of laughter, this fella's still got this erection and things like that. And anyway, it was only a kind of a quick medical after that. And then I do remember actually going out into London. You know, we had quite a few beers and things like that. I suppose people were getting together, they were celebrating their national service kind of come to an end, sort of thing, or coming to an end. And when we kind of came back, Woolwich Barracks was an old barracks where they, I suppose, originally used to keep the horses, and we was on the upper deck, for want of better words. And I remember I was when I came back, I suppose they had some drink, and I was violently sick over the barrier of this corridor type thing. And this was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I remember kind of this other guard commander was coming along, and he was yelling out, "Who's been sick?" sort of thing. And of course no one would answer and things like that. Then he threatened that owned up, sort of thing, he'd have the whole lot out, sort of thing. So eventually I owned up, and it was just a matter of getting one of the fire buckets and chucking a bucket of water over and things like that. And then when it came to the point of the papers to kind of go home, people were disappearing in ones and twos, you know, going to different places like Nottingham's and Liverpool's and places like that. And eventually mine actually came through, and I was quite upset because my papers was kind of destined to go to Northampton. And I thought, why do I want to go to Northampton when I could go to Ketchin? Because Northampton and Ketchin are on a different line. Ketchin is on the St Pancras line and Northampton is on the Euston line. So this was it. So I was then kind of given my papers to go to Northampton station. And when I got there, sort of thing, there was a regular sergeant major who was attached to the Territorial Army. He'd got a Land Rover at that time, and he was a nice fella, really. And his duty was really that he would then transport me to my home in Kettering. But the great problem really was I wasn't demobbed after 2 years. I was theoretically, I just transferred to the Territorial Army for the next 2.5 years, which upset most people, really, and things like that. So eventually he dropped me off at the home, which was quite good, really. It was door to door. But when I actually got home, the sad thing really was my parents were on holiday. I think they was either at Llandudno or Scarborough, one of those places. And also my elder brother, he was on holiday. He was at Blackpool. So when I actually got home, I came off there with two pouches, big pack, small pack, big thing, things like that. And I got home. There was no one there. And anyway, I did have my elder sister. She had a boyfriend at that time, and she looked after me theoretically and things like that. But you see, my parents had got no idea when I was actually coming home and things like that, and they got their holiday booked. In those days, the towns like Kettering, the shoe factories, they used to have the set holidays, you know, similar to, say, different to what we did in print. So when I actually got home, it was a real, real anti-climax. And got there, and of course, the housing where we lived in Kettering was like on the edge of the town. It was like open fields from then onwards. And all my friends as such, there was either in the army as such, or they'd actually got girlfriends, and they were going out and things like that. And I felt so desperately lonely. I always remember that. And on top of that, all I had this was this small amount of money, which they give you, kind of, I suppose, with Quim to say, like rations as such and things like that back home. And of course, I'd got this X amount of money in a army post office savings book. And I think it was well over £100. This was all the money which you could not spend, you know, being in the front line of career. You couldn't spend any money, so it just accrued as savings. But you couldn't get hold of it until so many weeks had gone past and things like that. My parents were away on holiday. My brothers were away on holiday. It was so quiet and things like that. I didn't really know what to do with myself. And of course, the problem also as well, with my civilian clothes and things like that, that didn't fit. And so up a period, I was actually wearing a uniform for about a week or so until my parents kind of come home. And then I used to kind of try and kill time. I used to walk into the centre of Kettering to kind of to find something to do. And
now, what were you going to do? I mean, what about work? I mean, because, you know, what were you going to do?
When I was called up for national service, you had the choice of either going in at 18 to 20 for 2 years, or you could finish your apprenticeship and go in at 21, and then you actually, when you came back, there was a chance that there would not be a job for you because you'd finish your contract with the firm. So as there were about half a dozen of us lads, a similar age group, we all decided we'd all go in at 18 and we'd come out at the age of 20. And then, of course, our apprenticeship didn't finish till we was 21 years of age. So we had at least another full year, you know, to get back into the system and things like that and kind of get back and that. So this is what we decided to do. And say, like, after about, if I remember rightly, although the National Service was 2 years, I think I calculated mine out because the Army owed me 1 month's leave because I'd had no real leave as such. And so my National Service worked out of 1 year, 11 months and about 3 weeks or something like that. So I'd got about 4 weeks leave money, and that, so after about 3 weeks I got so bored and didn't know what to do with myself, so I approached me, went to see my firm again, and they was quite pleased to see me and things like that. So
they were apprentices.
Yeah, I was still an apprentice. And so I went back there sort of thing. And I then went on this course to up in London sort of thing too, because it's in the, because it's all printing Fetter Lane and Fleet Street and around there. So I went on a course there and that, and then came back, and this is how it happened. And of course I swiftly got back into the system, and I was actually amazed really, because being in a factory environment, that kind of being for the last 2 years in open air sort of thing, I thought perhaps people, like a lot of people, they had problems, you know, settling down and things like that. But I had no problems whatsoever. And of course, I was then kind of part of the Territorial Army, and we had to.
So you didn't have any problems settling down to civilian life? I mean, after the disappointment of there being not much of a reception and your parents away, you didn't have much trouble getting used to being a civilian again?
No, I had no problems at all, because I settled quickly back into my apprenticeship and till that actually finished. And of course, then I was able to meet other people. I actually had to report to the Territorial Army down to the local drill.
I'll come to that. I'm keeping to your employment. So you no troubles with nightmares or anything like that? No trouble with...
No, I could be, because I was lucky really. I came back from Korea sort of thing. I was not killed, I was not wounded, I was not taken prisoner, I did not have any kind of nightmares like a lot of them actually did. The only thing, as I remember, kind of say, like, whilst I was still theoretically on leave from the army, kind of when my mother, so she used to bring me a mug of tea or something, or a cup of tea in the morning in bed and things like that, and I remember kind of I was asleep, and I remember kind of she... And I remember I grabbed her arm, and I think I quite frightened her really. She wondered what was happening, but I suppose it was going back, you know, I was still perhaps in the dugouts, take post, and you had to be out, things like that.
Now, can you just sketch out very briefly, we'll come to the TA thing next, but your career as a printer, because that was what you did, wasn't it? You finished your apprenticeship and became a printer. Can you just very quickly sketch that out for us?
Yes, in the printing sort of thing, it was all, because it was... mostly you had to be in a union, anyone couldn't really get into the print as such and thing of those days, and of course being you had to more or less had to be apprentice. And of course I was in the what you call the mechanical composition, because it was in those days it was all done with lead soldiers, for want of better words, and before the computers came in. And so that I then went on this course to the monotype school up in Fetter Lane in London and things like that, and then afterwards came back. And then I finished my apprenticeship, and then, of course, I was more or less partly, of course, the main person I was an apprentice under sort of thing, like he actually retired, he actually died, for want of better words, and I was more or less partly in charge. And of course, the firm I worked for, a firm called Staples, it was part of a large publishing group from London, and they used to have kind of firms in St Albans and Rochester's and lots in London itself. And it was very good. They used to have all these twice a year. They used to have these gatherings, mostly either St Albans, about the June period. They used to have this inter-firm cricket match and tennis matches and things like that, and they used to kind of issue with a train ticket, and used to go down there.
So that was who you stayed with for the rest of your printing career, was it?
No, and so eventually, kind of say, the firm itself. We then had, because it was very orientated towards sport, and so we then had a cricket team. Actually, in the local cricket league, and then we had a football team, and we also had a shooting team.
So, how long did you work as a printer? Was that your career?
I was in printing for the whole of my working life. So, I was at Staples in Kettering, and then say when I became the age of 26, sort of thing, I'd been going with this girl for quite a while, sort of thing, and I then had to make this decision: was I then going to go in for a kind of a large mortgage and blah 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 and get married as such? And so in the end, I decided at that time I was then having one or two continental holidays I was quite enjoying, and so I decided it was not for me at that time. So at the age of 26, we decided to move down to Watford in Hertfordshire, and I moved to another printer's where I was there for about a couple of years, and then about 2 years later that I then moved to the newspaper, the Watford Observer, which used to print lots and lots of print newspapers around that area. And from there I then stayed there for the next 27 years, I think it was, and until all the computer typesetting came in and we transferred over from the old, the hot metal to computers. And there I more or less stayed to the end of my time. And then when the period came when I was just over the 60s, I then had the opportunity, print was beginning to change, I had the opportunity, like most of them, if you wanted to, you could take a so-called redundancy. But at that time, my parents were getting kind of old sort of thing, getting a bit dodgy, so decided to take my redundancy and I'd return to my roots at Kettering. And then I got one or two little tiny jobs in print, and then I decided to come to an end.
So a successful career in printing. Now, it hadn't been disrupted by your military. Now, tell me about your TA service. Who did you do it with, and what did it consist of? Because sometimes it's quite a big thing and sometimes it's very small. Yeah. I mean, what was yours?
Now, when my national service came to an end, I was actually transferred. I was not demobbed as such, so I was transferred to the Territorial Army for the next 2.5 years. Now, I then had to report to the local drill hall,
which one was that?
Kettering Drill Hall, where at that time they had tanks for the tank corps and the tank regiments anyway, and also they had a gunner section, which turned out to be Beaufort. Now, this is one of the reasons why it upset me, really, because as an apprentice, there were six of us lads, and I felt that I'd done my part, really. I'd gone to the Far East, I'd been into the Korean War and things like that, and I was actually transferred to the Territorial Army, where many of these others who had been in the Royal Army Service Corps, the Remis and things like that, they didn't, because there was no kind of units of their types, they just went on purely reserve until I think they were the age of 40 something. But I was Territorial Army. Now, when I first...
So what was the name of this unit? You were attached to the Beaufort's gun unit, right? Yeah, this
unit, they had Beaufort guns, but they had more what I call more modern Beauforts than they had more electronic type Beauforts, where one person could operate. I think they were operated by big batteries.
Were they mobile?
No, they were.
So it's a Royal Artillery anti-aircraft unit.
Yes, it was.
But you don't know the number.
But the regiment itself, it did not have artillery. Although they were gunners, they did not have Royal Artillery badges. It then reverted back to the Northamptonshire badge, similar to I had when I was in the cadets. And so I was with those for 2 years.
Now, what do you remember? What was the nature of your commitment with them? I mean, what did you have to do?
What it was at that time, the great problem at that time, because I'd been trained as a driver as such in England, and of course, all the time we were actually driving in England, we just had a card, like a War Office type card to say drive. And I know we originally had a provisional driving license, but you see, when we went to abroad, went to Hong Kong, where I was also doing driving as well, that you didn't need a driver, you just need one of these War Office type driving license cards and things like that. So when I actually returned to England, because I also drove in Korea as well, the odd jeeps and that, but when I returned to England, I never had a proper British driving license. So when I reported to the territorial unit, say my experience as a driver and also kind of the TAR, where they didn't need TARs in, because this was ACAC rather than field. And so so I then went to, because I'd been on the signals as well, done signals, so I went more or less, my whole period in the Territorial Army was a signal and things like that. And the amazing thing was, because of, I think, the Americans in Germany at that time, they changed the complete wireless procedures and things like that. So that was a new thing to me.
But what were you doing as a signaller? What were you operating? I know you're not very keen on this bit, but...
Well, they had the normal sets. I think they had 38 sets, and I think they had 62 sets, and I think they had these little tiny 88 sets, and I'm not sure whether they had the 19 sets and things like that. But we had to report. We had to do so many evenings drills, as they call it, and then so many weekends, which was at Northampton drill hall, and where you went for the weekend, they took you over in three tonne of trucks and things like that, and then kind of you were then issued what they call these palliasses, where you went outside somewhere and you filled it up with straw, and there you would actually sleep on the floor of the main hall of the drill hall. And because people then had to empty the straw in the next on the Sunday morning before we went back home, sort of thing, people just wouldn't use it, sort of thing like that. So they used to either go out in the Saturday evening, sort of thing like that, either go to the normal salon dance hall, which quite a lot of us did, or others just went to the pubs and what have you. And when we used to come back about 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning, used to put our overcoat on and sleep straight on the floor, things like that. But you see, it was